For the ancient Romans, throwing a dinner party was the most important social function, where they made contacts, they cut business deals, they discussed politics, and who was invited, what was served, and of course, how rare and expensive the ingredients, all of those are of utmost importance.
Welcome back to Food, a Cultural Culinary History, a podcast brought to you by The Great Courses Plus. I'm Jason Smigel, and like you, I'm a lifelong learner. I've been listening to The Great Courses for over 14 years, and I'm excited to be sharing this great course as a podcast with you. This podcast is hosted by Ken Albala, who's professor of history and chair of food studies at the University of the Pacific. He's also the author of Ken Albala's Food Rant, a highly popular blog for people who love food. Episode 9, Dining in Republican and Imperial Rome. In this episode, we're going to ancient Rome, where we'll delve into some intriguing contrasts in the dining habits of the ancient Romans. We'll examine simple food customs of Republican Rome, and then trace the expanding empire and learn how exotic food became a status symbol. We're going to read from an ancient Roman cookbook aimed at those eager to flaunt their wealth, and then we'll bear witness to the gastronomic decadence of the late empire. As always, if you're interested in trying any of Ken's recipes and food experiments, or even seeing photos and illustrations of the concepts that Ken mentions in this podcast, you can find supporting materials for this podcast at thegreatcoursesdaily.com.
Today, we are going to discuss ancient Roman dining habits and how they changed over time, as, of course, did the Roman people themselves. We will start with the simple warlike Romans in the Republican period, trace the expansion of the empire and how food came to be a marker of social class, especially when the wealthiest of Romans, only they could afford exotic luxuries. We'll then examine a cookbook specifically written for those who wanted to flaunt their wealth and sophistication, as well as authors who rejected gastronomic decadence as symptomatic of a culture in decline. But let's begin with the Republican period, one of great frugality. To start, the early Romans were an austere, self-sufficient, and warlike people whose food consisted primarily of those staples we really still associate with the Mediterranean diet. Wheat and barley, eaten mostly as pulmentum, and that's actually the original version of polenta, just a porridge. Cheese, olive oil, vegetables, and then just a little meat now and then. There was little social differentiation based on diet. Most people ate pretty much the same basic, simple, locally grown foods. And we get a good example of what Romans in the Republican period were like from an agricultural manual written by Cato the Elder. You may know Cato. He's infamous in Roman history as the official censor of the state who, even after two crushing victories against the Carthaginians, their dire enemy, insisted that the Carthaginians be completely obliterated. And, you know, in the Senate, he, regardless of the topic under discussion, he'd pound his fist on the rostrum, shouting, "Carthago delenda est! Carthago must be destroyed! Carthage must be destroyed!" And in fact, it was in the Third Punic War, as legend would have it, by sowing salt into the soil so nothing would ever grow again. Now, the question, why would a Roman statesman write a book about agriculture? It's partly because the Romans fought seasonally. They would return to their farms for sowing and harvesting, and being a patrician, people of Cato's social class would often inherit large sums of money, or they might earn a pension after retiring from service in the military. And so for early Romans, the safest investment was land. And the manual describes how to invest in land, how to plant vineyards and olive groves, fruit trees, and how to grow crops that could be easily transported back to the cities for profit, right? And the foods are, you know, they're simple, uncomplicated staples. But he has some recipes, too, for sacrificial cakes and things like that. One in particular, which I really love, is called placenta. I know that sounds horrible, but it's from the word, the Greek word plakunta, which means a flat cake. And in fact, the anatomical use of that term for afterbirth originates many centuries of later, from apparently the similarity of the placenta shape to a pancake. So Cato's placenta is essentially these sheets of dough layered with fresh cheese, and then the whole thing soaked in honey. So it's sort of like a sweet lasagna. You know, it's certainly nothing extravagant or exotic. Rich and poor in the Republican period ate basically the same frugal diet. And if one section of Cato's book is any indication, they had what I would call an inordinate fondness for cabbage, you know, as food and as medicine. But food for the early Romans was basically just food. No particular foods were associated with social class, and there were a few luxuries by which people could flaunt their wealth. But that changes in a period of social climbers and when we get to the Imperial Rome. And what happens is as the Roman Empire expanded, and especially after conquering Greece and much of the Eastern Mediterranean, these simple, warlike people came in contact with cultures not only much older, but much more sophisticated and much wealthier. And these older cultures had also been long addicted to luxuries. I mean, these are the spices that come from Asia. So for the first time, the Romans were connected to ancient trade routes, which brought them pepper and cinnamon from India, even products from the Far East like citron, ginger, cloves. Those are a little bit later, but still. Because these were expensive imports, they were excellent markers of social status, and only the wealthiest people could afford them. But in the minds of many Romans, contact with the East had made this once fierce people soft. And naturally, as Rome grew, its administration expanded. Its cities swelled to enormous proportions, and most importantly, its armies teemed with fresh recruits to protect the borders of this now vast empire. And of course, all these people needed to be fed, right? Huge plantations, what are called latifundia, that are worked by slave labor, they provided the wheat. The wheat was milled on a massive scale and now eaten in the form of risen bread, which was actually doled out by the state as a form of welfare. You remember bread and circuses? I mean, they thought all you need for ordinary people to be happy is to give them a circus, that means a circuit, a chariot race, and bread, and you can do anything else you want. As you can imagine, with such great demand for food and extensive trade, which is exactly what those great Roman roads were built for, there was also widespread speculation in foodstuffs, right? And this includes both basic staples as well as luxuries like that infamous fish sauce that went into almost all Roman dishes. It's called garum. It's sort of like nukmam, you know, that sauce that comes from Southeast Asia, or nampla. They're similar. The Romans were also serious connoisseurs of garum, and they insisted on the finest imported all the way from Spain. They planted vineyards, they made wine of such quality that it could be kept for decades. And if you think about it, in a boom economy like this, great fortunes could be easily made and lost. And there was a remarkable degree of social mobility as well. I mean, examples of people even starting as slaves, buying their freedom, and eventually becoming wealthy in trade. So the theme of this lecture, and a food theme we'll return to, of course, throughout the course, is that when people suddenly make a lot of money and they're able to rise up socially, they naturally try to imitate their superiors, right? They begin to dress like them, they learn to speak properly, they buy expensive villas, and most importantly, they want to eat the same foods that the wealthy do. Because only the richest of people can afford exotic luxuries and even expert cooks to prepare them. So food, we have to keep in mind, it's an unmistakable marker of social class. You know, and to sort of fit among the upper class, you have to eat like them too. Moreover, for the ancient Romans, throwing a dinner party was the most important social function, where they made contacts, they cut business deals, they discussed politics, and who was invited, what was served, and of course, how rare and expensive the ingredients, all of those are of utmost importance. Thus, social aspirants were, in a sense, performing their new status at every dinner party they threw, right? And nouveau riche, the people who had quickly become rich, they might not know exactly how to do it tastefully, right? And in fact, they needed to rub elbows with the elites precisely to learn how to act their class. You know, just as children learn to act their age, that's exactly what's going on. The Romans had very precise dining rituals as well. They ate in the evening, like we do. Usually a late afternoon visit to the baths, so they would be fresh and clean for dinner. The diners did not sit at tables, but they reclined on couches, usually three people per couch in sets of three arranged in a U shape. That's an arrangement called a triclinium. They also ate with their hands, which explains why they needed a lot of servants to offer water for washing or to bring in platters of food. And they basically set these on low tables in the center. So where you are seated is of great importance. You know, a particular spot is reserved just for the host, another for the guest of honor, and then the lesser people are literally reclining behind others on the same couch. And I know it seems really odd to us today, but status and placement were very important, as was it knowing exactly how to behave at a dinner party. So it is in this context that I'd like to introduce a little story. And I'm going to be reading little vignettes about Roman dinner parties throughout this lecture. But let's start with one which is a satire, or the original name is Satyricon. It's written by a nobleman named Petronius. And he was actually of such noble birth and discernment that he served as an official arbiter of taste in the court of the Emperor Nero. In other words, Petronius was old money, and exactly the sort of person who would resent these upstarts trying to muscle their way into the finer social circles, right? In fact, the historian Tacitus gives us a description of Petronius. He says, his days were spent entirely sleeping, while at night he looked after the necessities and pleasures of life. He was not considered a glutton and a spendthrift, but rather a refined pleasure seeker who was brought into the circle of the emperor's favorite few and became the arbiter of good taste in Nero's reign, the person who, amid such wealth, determined what was beautiful and delicate. Now, considering who Petronius was, let's look at this Satyricon. It features a guy named Trimalchio, who was a former slave, now free, who struck it rich speculating in grain, and who now decides that he's going to throw the most elegant dinner party imaginable to impress upon his guests not only his wealth, but his sophistication and his good taste. And this is why he invites these two young nobles, Encolpius and Ascyltus, who serve as the narrators of this little story. From the very start, the young nobles are scandalized by the stupendously dreadful taste of their host, Trimalchio. First of all, the halls are hung with pictures of Trimalchio. And then slaves clip their toenails before they enter, which is okay. And when they get to the dining room, there's this big brass donkey with dishes slung from its mouth. There's olives on one side, and the other has dormice dipped in honey and sprinkled with poppy seeds. And yes, you heard me right. The Romans ate mice. They even fattened them in these little perforated clay jars called gliraria. Gliris is the term for dormouse. So finally, Trimalchio appears, and he proceeds to ignore his guests, and that's really considered really impolite. He even slaps around a slave who drops a platter. I mean, it's just awful, awful behavior. And then he presides over more disgusting attempts to show off his wealth and sophistication. There's a wooden hen lays eggs made of pastry that contain whole tiny birds in a spiked yolk. And then there's a whole boar with a hat on its head, and when it's sliced open, it spills out all these blood sausages. Cakes spurt saffron on guests when they try to eat them. And then there are 12 dishes are planned around a zodiac theme. So there's beef steaks for Taurus. There's a bull's eye for Sagittarius, remember the archer. There's testicles and kidneys for the twins Gemini. There's a sow's womb for Virgo. Goes on and on. Needless to say, this is all in very, very bad taste. The satire is clearly a warning to all social upstarts that no matter how much money you have, no matter what exotic foods you serve, you're probably going to make a complete ass of yourself if you try and throw a dinner party, just like Trimalchio. Of course, the author, Petronius, would have never needed to issue such a warning if his social position was secure. It's only with great mobility that food becomes invested with social meaning. And ironically, we don't know exactly why, but Petronius was accused of some grave offense to the emperor, and he chose to commit suicide rather than await his sentence and probably have to kill himself. So his life was in fact much more precarious than he could ever have imagined.
If you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts, the new audio and video streaming site from The Great Courses, the leader in lifelong learning, featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from game theory, communication skills, ancient art, British India, nutrition, and a whole lot more. At The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.
Let's go on about imperial extravagance. The story of Trimalchio seems to shed light on the most famous cookbook of classical antiquity. It's De Re Coquinaria, means on cooking things, of Apicius. Now, who exactly this Apicius was has been a matter of speculation for centuries. There was an actual person named Marcus Gavius Apicius, who lived in the first century AD, who was known for his exquisite taste and for the extravagant sums he spent on food. In fact, there's one story that recounts how Apicius heard about the largest shrimp anyone had ever seen being sold on the coast of northern Africa. So he immediately gets in a boat, sails all the way there, took one look at the shrimp, and says, not so impressive. And he turns around and sails home. And he never even set foot on shore. So the story goes. Seneca, the philosopher writer, says that when Apicius realized he was running out of money, rather than cut back the scale of his lavish dinner parties and suffer humiliation, he poisoned himself. Now, whether a real figure or not, the name Apicius was universally associated with magnificent dining and extravagance and profligacy, if not outright gluttony. But there's this cookbook, and the recipes in the cookbook, even though they're probably gathered several centuries after the historical Apicius lived, nonetheless, they bear witness to this reputation for lavishness. There are directions for making boiled ostrich served in a sauce of pepper, mint, cumin, celery seed, dates, honey, vinegar, raisin wine, what's passum, garum, and oil, and then thickened with starch. Now stop just for a moment and consider the wild juxtapositions of flavor here. You've got sweet and sour and savory and spicy and salty, and they're all competing for attention in one dish, right? And the ingredients also, think about this, they come from the far-flung corners of the empire, right? And beyond, in fact, the African ostrich, the Indian pepper, the dates that come from the Middle East, the garum comes from Spain. So what could this odd flavor combination possibly mean, apart from revealing the seriously jaded palates of Roman diners? Well, foremost, I think it is designed to impress wealth and sophistication. And as a cookbook, it's also teaching someone how to cook dishes which are unfamiliar, right? In other words, this cookbook seems designed precisely to appeal to those social aspirants like Trimalchio, people who want to get it all right at their next dinner party, right? Someone who owns the cookbook would presumably dictate precise directions for these dishes to their cooks, who are probably illiterate. And in some cases, the recipes match exactly those served by Trimalchio in the satire. There's stuffed dormice, there's sow's womb, there's flamingos' tongues, and things perhaps appreciated precisely for, I don't know, their gross-out factor, as well as their rarity. The vast majority of recipes also feature the ingenuity of the cook, you know, in sort of transforming ingredients into something completely new. Here's one of my favorites. It's a rose patina that's made of pounded brains and rose petals, steamed with eggs in a shallow custard-like tart. Now, to be fair, there are also pretty ordinary ingredients and simple recipes in the cookbook of Apicius. It's not all bizarre foods. Nonetheless, it seems like the appearance of these oddities suggests an audience eager to try out strange recipes to impress their dinner guests, people who are social aspirants who will be judged basically by the food that they serve. And thus, they must choose foods which denote status. So it has to be things that are rare and unusual ingredients, complex cooking methods, and ingenious tricks to try and titillate guests. Now, to analyze an ancient recipe, you have to consider what diners would have thought about it. All right, I mean, the same way that we have explicit associations with certain foods. Some may be comfort foods, right? I mean, macaroni and cheese. Others are reserved for holidays and celebrations. We think of that immediately when we say roast turkey, there it is. And some foods we associate with romantic dinners, right? Caviar, champagne. Sometimes we'll associate foods with specific places. Think hot dogs at a ballpark, right? So what I'm going to suggest is that we should really be careful not to project our own associations onto an ancient dish, okay? Because their associations are different. But here is an example of a recipe which even bears the name of Apicius, which will give you a good sense of Roman elite taste. It's called a minutal Apicianum, or Apician stew. And it starts with a list of ingredients that just go into the pot, okay? So I'll read them. It's oil, garum, fish sauce, wine, leeks, mint, small fish, and this would have been considered pretty elegant, capon's testicles, I'll come back to that in a moment, suckling pig's sweetbreads. I know that may also sound odd, but it's actually very mild and delicate. Cook all this together, pound pepper, lovage, sort of like celery leaf, cilantro, coriander seed, moisten with garum, add a bit of honey and some of its own broth, temper with wine and honey, heat it up and break in tracta to thicken, stir it up and sprinkle on pepper and serve. And the tracta I just mentioned there are kind of an ancestor of pasta. They're sort of thin sheets of dough that are baked and then you crumble them into a stew to thicken it so it kind of holds together. Okay, they're not boiled, but they're similar to pasta. Now, I'm sure many of us cringe when we think of eating rooster testicles, but if we look at what the Romans wrote about them, we find they did not think testicles weird at all. In fact, the physician Galen says rooster testicles are the best in every respect, especially from grain-fed roosters. We also learn from agricultural writers that Columella, roosters were castrated to create capons precisely because they grow fat and tame and are much more tender and tastier than roosters. But also because you only need one rooster in a hen house, you want to keep the largest one for reproduction. So the testicles are oddly something you'd have on hand often. We might also consider another interesting association Romans might have had with testes, the Latin root testis, when you swear an oath or testify. You're swearing on the family jewels, so to speak. But in any case, the ingredients here were anything but weird, and when sauced with herbs and spices, wine, honey, fish sauce, it actually becomes a really interesting melange of textures and flavors. It's similar to something I think you'd find in a Chinese restaurant today. But most importantly, it's sophisticated, it's complex, it's very different from what ordinary Roman plebeians would be eating. It's a marker of distinction. Now let's talk about the people who reject this way of eating. Another example I think will further illustrate the important social function of dinner parties for the Romans. And incidentally, there was not a special room where guests would go to relieve themselves with a feather so they could eat more. There's no vomitorium. That's actually a place to exit a stadium. It means to go out, vom ire. But this story is also a satire. It's the fifth written by the poet Juvenal. And it highlights how, if you wanted to be somebody, you need to attach yourself to an important person and get yourself invited to dinner. Networking is crucial to status. And only at the dinner, Juvenal describes, something strange happens. The host gets really nice food and the guest is given basically garbage. The host in this case, his name is Vero, and he served wine made when the consuls were bearded. That means over 100 years before. And Trebius, the guest, gets a jug of plunk. The host eats lobster and asparagus. Trebius gets a shriveled prawn and half an egg. The host eats huge mullet. And the Romans were crazy about big mullet. They spent a fortune for them. And Trebius gets a spotty old pike. The host eats fine white bread. The guest gets a stale crust of brown bread. Now, it's obvious. The host is consciously reminding his guests about their inferior status through the food served, or not served, as the case may be. But I want you to imagine throwing a dinner party today and enjoying something like a Chateaubriand of beef yourself while offering your guests McDonald's burgers and fries. It would be a horrible insult. I mean, most of all, because we like to think of ourselves as equals. So everyone has to be served the same food. The Romans, or at least this particular host, seems to be just rubbing it in, telling his clients, you're dependent on me, and you should grovel at my table and be happy that I'm throwing you scraps. Juvenal writes this. He says, maybe you think Vero is cheap. That's hardly the reason. He does this to hurt on purpose. What comedy ever, what buffoon is more fun than a gut that rumbles in protest? So in case you don't know, all this is done to compel you, force you to tears of rage and the grinding of squeaky molars. In other words, this is kind of like a cruel joke, says the poet. Now, the point of this whole satire is revealed when Juvenal tells his young friend, Trebius, forget about these invitations. They're demeaning. You don't need to grovel like that to mean patrons. It's not worth the humiliation. And then in another satire, number 11, Juvenal tells his friend, you know, instead of that garbage, come by my humble country place instead, where we'll be served good, fresh, honest food right on the farm. Here's what we're going to have, things you can't get in a market. You know, from the field I own near Tivoli, he says, you can count on the fattest kid in the flock. And the tenderest, one who has never learned about grass, meaning it's still suckling, nor dared to nibble the twigs of the willow, with more milk in him than blood. And mountain asparagus gathered by my foreman's wife after she's finished weaving. And there will be fresh eggs, great big ones, warm from the nest with straw wisps stuck on the shells. And we'll cook the chickens that laid them. And he continues about the delicious fruits and the grapes and the pears and apples. And just like today, there are those, not due to lack of money, but an alternative aesthetic, who reject fancy and expensive food, and they want honest, simple ingredients prepared without fuss. And this is merely another way to mark social distinction through food, right? When wealth and ostentation no longer suffice, you eat simple food. And it's a way to set yourself apart. You know, when any nouveau riche can afford the latest fashion, this way of eating is a kind of cultural capital, savoir-faire, knowing where to find the best ingredients or raising them yourself, even better. Your rich men now have no real pleasure in dining. This is a quote. The fish and the game are insipid. The roses and the perfume stink. And Juvenal makes fun of these exotic ingredients, right? The perverse combinations of flavor. The hares and the sow's udders and the boars and the springboks and pheasants and flamingos and Gaetulian gazelles. And remember, think about this. These are exactly the kind of dishes Trimalchio served and for which Apicius provided the recipes. But Juvenal insists, no such nonsense as this in my humble house. And like Petronius, Juvenal rejects culinary extravagance, but he reinvents his own kind of rustic aesthetic based on the quality of ingredients. Now, lastly, let's talk about the gastronomic perversity of the late empire. And I think this final example of an extravagant dinner party will round out our picture of Roman dining habits. This is one from, you know, admittedly, it's written from a negative vantage point, and it's intended to link food habits with sexual perversity and moral depravity and such. But in other words, it's criticizing a person's corrupt dining habits, and it serves as a warning to readers. And this is a narrative written by the historian Aelius Lampridius. It's a description of the banquets thrown by the emperor Heliogabalus, or Elagabalus, who ruled from, he was really young, and only for a few years, 218 to 222. And this Heliogabalus, apart from being a transvestite and an exhibitionist and a sadist, I mean, he would enter a room on a chariot pulled by naked women. I mean, he also liked to pull pranks on his dinner guests. He would serve them all blue food or all green food. And Aelius says this, I'm quoting, in imitation of Apicius, he often ate camel's heels and cock's combs taken from living birds and the tongues of peacocks and nightingales. He also served thrushes' brains, the heads of parrots, pheasants and peacocks, and he used to order mullets' beards to be brought in, so large that he served them like cress. You know what I'm talking about here? The mullet has this stringy little bit hanging down below its mouth. It's a kind of beard. Heliogabalus also served sow's udder for 10 successive days. And that was one of his biggest jokes. He would see how long he could serve the same food at every meal until nothing. He also threw a banquet in which all the food was just painted on the table or made of wax or wood, and then pretended nothing was wrong. My favorite joke, though, is he kept a tame bear and he would lock his guests in a room with it. And when they got drunk, just for kicks, and then he would sort of give away door prizes. And that might be a sack of gold on one day or a bag of jewels. Or the other days it would be a dead dog or a pound of chopped meat. I mean, the guy, he definitely had a perverse sense of humor. So in the end, what happens is he was murdered and his body was thrown into the sewer. But telling this story was meant to be a warning against gluttony and perversion for readers, but also it was a warning to emperors not to abuse their power lest they be turned on by an angry mob. And of course, we need to take this story with a grain of salt, to borrow a food metaphor. The author, trying to discredit the emperor, could certainly have exaggerated or filled in all the lurid details to prove his point. But the larger lesson to be learned here is that food, while at one level merely something ingested to nourish us, also has much deeper meaning and especially vivid associations with class. Food is a marker of identity that can be used in ways that express who we wish to be like, or as in this last example, who we should revile and detest. And the extravagance of the ancient Romans, depending on your vantage point, could be either an appealing expression of social aspiration, the object of ridicule, or even a dire warning.
Thanks for listening to episode 9 of Food, A Cultural Culinary History. Just a reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast and want more of the same, you can find hundreds of audio courses on all sorts of topics, all taught by brilliant professors like Ken Albala, at thegreatcoursesplus.com/podcasts. Featuring in-depth courses on subjects ranging from cultural geography, pain relief, philosophy, mathematic visualization, you name it, at The Great Courses Plus, you can learn everything about anything.